After walking for 2 hours, we were looking for a place to have breakfast, when suddenly I saw her stop abruptly, her ears cocked and her body tense with excitement. The next moment she was off, jumping noiselessly down the rocks, which flanked the river at this point. Then she disappeared into the thick undergrowth below. Here the river is divided by several islets, each an impenetrable thicket of bush, fallen trees and debris. We'd stopped to wait for the outcome of her stalk, when we heard, as I thought, the unmistakable sound of elephant trumpeting. George disagreed, saying that the noise was made by a buffalo. We waited for at least 5 minutes, hoping that Elsa would get bored as she usually did. Then came a deep rumbling sound, and before I realized what was happening, George leapt down the rocks, saying that Elsa was in trouble. I followed as fast as I could, but was brought to a halt by a fresh outburst of violent bellowing just ahead. Instinctively, the man and myself stopped and called to George not to go on, but nothing would deter him, and he disappeared behind the green walls of creepers and trees. Now we heard an ear-splitting scream, followed by urgent shouts from George. "Come, quick, quick!" My heart turned to lead. An accident must have happened. As I stumbled as fast as I could through the thicket, terrible scenes flashed through my mind. But soon, thank God, I saw George's sunburnt back through the foliage. He was standing upright, so all must be well. When I finally broke through the bush to the river bank, what I saw was Elsa, dripping wet, sitting on top of a bull buffalo in the middle of the rapids. I could not believe my eyes. Here was a buffalo, helplessly forced down with his head half submerged, while Elsa tore away at its thick skin and attacked from every angle. He could only guess at what had happened. Elsa must have disturbed the buffalo, an old bull past his prime, as we later discovered, while he was resting close to the water, and chased him towards the river. Then, in his attempt to cross, he must have fallen on the slippery rock of the rapids, and Elsa had taken advantage of his predicament, jumped on him, and held his head under water until he was half drowned and too exhausted to get up. George waited, and Elsa gave him a chance to end the unfortunate animal's agony with a merciful bullet. As soon as this coup de grace had been delivered, we saw Nuru wade waist-deep into the foaming rapids. He could not resist the chance of gorging himself on this mountain of meat, but as he was a Mohammedan, he would not be able to eat the buffalo unless he had cut its throat before it died. From her position on top of the buffalo, Elsa watched his every movement with tense excitement. Although she had known Nuru since she was a tiny cub, and had allowed him every sort of familiarity, she was now highly suspicious, and with flattened ears and threatening growls, defended her buffalo even against her nanny. She looked really dangerous, but Nuru, driven by gluttonous visions, paid no heed to her warnings. As he advanced, he waved his first finger at her, calling, "No! No!" Incredible as it may seem, Elsa obeyed him, and sitting quietly on top of the buffalo, allowed him to cut its throat. The next problem was to get the dead beast out of the river. We had to drag it through the rapids between the slippery rocks. To achieve moving 1,200 pounds in such circumstances, with an excited lioness guarding it, was no easy task. But Elsa, intelligent as she is, soon realized what was required, and by seizing him by the root of the tail, while three men pulled at the head and legs, literally helped to get the buffalo out. Their joint strength succeeded in hauling out the carcass, which was then cut up. Here again, Elsa was most helpful. Each time one of the big, heavy legs was severed from the body, she at once dragged it into the shade of a bush, thus saving the boys the task of doing it later on. Luckily, we were able to bring the Land Rover to within a mile of the scene, and managed to get most of the meat to camp. When I joined her, she licked my arm, embraced me with her paws, and avoided scratching me with claws that only a few minutes ago had been so deadly to the thick skin of a powerful buffalo. Even for a wild lion, it would have been a remarkable achievement to kill a buffalo bull single-handed, let alone for Elsa, who had only recently learned the art of hunting from her very inferior foster parents. Although the river had been a good ally to her, it had needed considerable intelligence on her part to take advantage of it, and I felt very proud of her. Not long afterwards, we were walking together along the shady river bank, when Elsa sniffed with great interest at a bush and wrinkled up her nose, a thing she often did when scenting a lion. Now we saw fresh pug marks nearby, and Elsa, who was purring distinctly, followed the spoor and disappeared. She kept away all night and the following day. When in the afternoon we looked for her, we detected her through field glasses outlined on her favourite rock. She must have seen us, for we heard her calling, but she made no attempt to move from her position. Thinking she might be near wild lions, we did not want to interfere and returned home. While we were having our dinner next evening, she walked into the tent, rubbed her head affectionately against me, and then went out and spent the night away. In the morning we tracked her spoor over a long distance. It led far away. That evening she failed to come back. She had now kept away for 3 days, except for brief visits during which she'd shown us her affection. Might this be her touching way of telling us that she had found her pride, and while she still loved us, was trying to loosen our ties? During the night we were awakened by the most alarming lion growls, mixed with the laughing of hyenas. We listened, expecting Elsa to come in at any moment, but morning dawned and she did not return. As soon as it became light, we went in the direction from which the growls had come, but stopped after a few hundred yards, startled by an unmistakable lion grunt coming from the river below us. Creeping cautiously down to the river, we found the fresh pug marks of at least 2 or 3 lions in the sand. They led across the river. Wading through, we followed the still wet spoor up the opposite bank, when I noticed, not 50 yards away, through the dense bush, the shape of a lion. While I strained my eyes to see if it was Elsa, George called to her. She walked away from us. When George repeated his call, she only trotted faster along the game path, until we saw the black tuft on the end of her tail switch for the last time through the bush. We looked at each other. Had she found her destiny? She must have heard us. By following the lions, she had decided her future. Did this mean that our hopes for her to return to her natural life had been fulfilled? Had we succeeded in letting her part from us, without hurting her? We returned to camp alone and very sad. Should we leave her now, and so close a very important chapter of our lives? George suggested that we should wait a few more days to make sure that Elsa had been accepted by the pride. I went into my studio by the river and continued to write the story of Elsa, who had been with us until this morning. I was sad to be alone, but tried to make myself happy by imagining that at this very moment Elsa was rubbing her soft skin against another lion's skin and resting with him in the shade, as she had often rested with me. To us it seemed impossible, after more than 3 years of such close companionship, that we should lose all touch with Elsa. As George, in the course of his duties, is constantly travelling, we have endeavoured to pay a visit to the area where Elsa lives, at intervals of about 3 weeks. On arrival in camp, we always fire a shot or two, or let off a thunder flash, and on nearly every occasion she has come running into camp within a few hours, giving us a great welcome and showing more affection than ever. Once it was 15 hours before she came, and once 30 hours, when she must have been very far off and sensed our arrival in some mysterious way. During our 3 day stay, she never lets us out of her sight and is touchingly glad to be with us. When the time comes for us to leave, George goes about 10 miles away and shoots a buck or a warthog as a farewell gift to Elsa, while the tents are being struck and loaded up. In the meantime, I sit with her in my studio under the big tree and try to divert her mind. As soon as the buck arrives, she has a good feed, though we usually find her fat and well. She obviously learned long ago to make her own kills, and is quite independent of us for food. While she's eating, the loaded cars are taken about a mile away, and as she becomes drowsy after her meal, we sneak away. For some time before the final parting, she becomes noticeably aloof and turns her face away from us, although she wants desperately to be with us. Yet when she realizes we are going, she makes it easier in this touching, dignified and controlled way. As this happens every time, it can hardly be a coincidence. A short time later, I went to England to arrange for the publication of Elsa's book. During the months I've spent in London, George has written me accounts of all his visits to Elsa, and her story is carried on by his letters. They prove not only her continued ability to combine the life of a wild lioness with her old relationship with us, but also that this relationship continues to be one of absolute equality, quite different from that between a dog and his master. Isiolo, 5th of March, 1959. I was able to get off to see Elsa on the evening of the 25th. Obviously, she was much puzzled that you were not there, and went several times into your tent and looked inside the lorry, calling. However, she soon settled down into the usual routine, except that she absolutely refused to leave the camp for a walk. She would go to the studio in the morning and spend the whole day there with me. When I brought her a buck on Sunday morning, she would not let anyone go near it and was quite fierce. But as soon as I went down to the studio, she dragged the buck along, deposited it by my seat, and did not mind my cutting it up. In the afternoon I said, "Elsa, time to go home." She waited until I picked up the remains of the buck, and then solemnly walked ahead to the tent. Isiolo, 19th of March. No sign of her being in contact with lions. On this trip, I did not hear any. As I had only the mountain tent with me, it was a bit crowded at night with Elsa in it as well, but she behaved very well, and never once wetted the ground sheet. As usual, she would wake me up several times at night by rubbing noses and sitting on me. There was no trouble in leaving her, which I did on Wednesday. In fact, I think she is becoming more independent and does not mind being left alone. I really have no patience with people who maintain that an animal's life and actions are governed by pure instinct and conditioned reflexes. Nothing except reasoning power can explain the careful strategy used by a pride of lions in hunting, and the many examples we have had from Elsa of intelligent and thought-out behaviour. 27th of April, 1959. On Sunday morning, as we were in the studio, Elsa in deep sleep behind, I saw an 8-foot croc come out of the water onto the rocks opposite. I crawled to the edge of the river and took a cine shot and crept away to get my rifle from camp. Finally shot it through the neck. It never moved off the rocks. I sent Makede over to tie a rope round its neck and then pulled it across. Elsa watched the proceedings with much interest but hadn't spotted the croc, not until it was close into the bank. She approached it very carefully, put out a paw, and tapped it on the nose cautiously, and then, satisfied it was dead, seized hold of it and brought it onto the bank, making a frightful grimace of disgust. She made no attempt to eat it, preferring a pig, which by now was very high. 12th of May. Made camp on the 5th of May, no sign of Elsa. On Saturday morning with heavy heart I started to pack up. I'd been away a week already. Suddenly, in she came, dripping wet, looking as fit as ever. She was full of affection and so pleased to see me. Elsa is certainly more independent and goes farther afield and no longer has to rely on me for food. She is perhaps a little more suspicious of strange Africans, and will not let Nuru or Makede come too near when she's with her meat. When it comes to moving the meat, either from the tent to the studio in the morning, or from the studio to the tent in the evening, I have to carry it with Elsa marching behind. Even in the little mountain tent, Elsa brings the meat into it, and I just have to put up with it, or if it is too smelly, move my bed outside. Obviously she knows that when the meat is put near me, it is quite safe. I feel sure that when she has cubs, she will bring them along and deposit them with me to look after. I look forward to seeing Elsa again. She was rather pathetic when I left her the last time. I tried to sneak away unseen, but when I looked back she was standing on the edge of the salt lick watching me go away. She never made any attempt to follow. I felt like a thief stealing away. George had arranged his local leave to coincide with my return to Kenya, and soon we were on our way to Elsa. When we arrived at her camp, it was already getting dark. About 20 minutes later, while we were putting up my tent, we heard the well-known barking of baboons coming from the river. These always heralded Elsa's arrival. George suggested that I should get into the truck until Elsa had used up a little of her energy in greeting him, as he was afraid that in her excitement at seeing me after such a long parting, she might not be able to control her great strength and might do me some injury. Rather reluctantly, I followed his advice and watched her welcome him, but after a few minutes I got out. Suddenly she saw me, and as though it were the most natural thing in the world, walked quietly over from George and started rubbing her face against my knees and meowing in her usual way. Then, with claws well tucked in, she used her 300 pounds to bowl me over, after which she played in her usual friendly way without any fuss or excitement. For the night, we decided that I would put my camp bed into my truck, in case Elsa might feel inclined to share it with me. This proved a wise precaution, for soon after the lamps were turned out, she crept determinedly through the thorn fence which surrounded my tent, and standing on her hind legs, looked into the truck, and satisfied herself that I was there. However, after this she settled down next to the car till the early morning. For the next 6 days, Elsa shared our camp routine and our morning and evening walks. One day she had a wonderful game in the river with a stick which George had thrown to her. She retrieved it, leapt in cabrioles around it, splashing all the water she could whip up with her tail. While George was filming her near the water's edge, she pretended not to notice him, but cunningly manoeuvred herself closer and closer. Then she suddenly dropped the stick and leapt on the poor fellow. When George tried to get his revenge, she hopped away and with unbelievable swiftness climbed a sloping tree trunk out of everyone's reach. There she sat, licking her paws, looking utterly innocent. After this performance, Elsa only paid us short visits for the next 2 days and became very detached. On the 29th of July, we saw her on the high rock ridge, and after a few minutes calling, she joined us, purring repeatedly and affectionately, but soon returned to her rock. Now we saw that she was in season, which explained her recent behaviour. We decided to break camp. As our two cars passed below her rock, she appeared on the skyline and watched us driving away. On the 29th of August, George was obliged to go to Elsa's area for game control. Early next morning, he saw Elsa sitting on a rock almost hidden by a bush. She seemed very restless and kept on looking intently downstream. First she meowed, then with a startled woof, woof, dashed down the rock and streaked past George into the bush. Next moment, a young lion appeared, evidently in hot pursuit, and not sensing George, came straight towards him. When the lion was less than 20 yards away, George thought it time to act and waved his arms and shouted. Startled, the beast spun round and made off the way he had come. A few seconds later, Elsa reappeared, squatted nervously close to George for a few moments, and then followed the lion. George withdrew and moved camp. It was between the 29th of August and the 4th of September 1959 that George saw Elsa and her lion mating. Quickly he made a calculation, 108 days gestation. This meant that cubs might arrive between the 15th and the 21st of December. When on his return to Isiolo, he told me what he had seen, I could hardly wait to start off for camp, for I was afraid that Elsa might now follow her mate into a world beyond our reach. But when we arrived, she was there waiting for us by the big rock, close to the car track. She was very affectionate and also very hungry. As our tents were being pitched, her lion started calling, and during the night he circled round the camp, while she remained with George, eating heartily and quite uninterested in her mate's appeal. At dawn, we heard the lion still calling, but from much farther away. For 2 days, she remained in camp, eating so enormously